And what's going to make a game package and collect? Well, contrary to popular belief, it's not hot stamping or spot glossing. It's just making sure that it communicates properly and that it's got an aesthetic that people are going to want to display.
What kinds of cardboard box?
What's in the box?
Oh, what's in the box?
It loses its value if you take it out of the package.
Hey, PDU crew, today we've got Matt Nuccio joining us. He runs a company called Design Edge. Now, these guys develop toys, board games, and all the packaging that goes with it. Everything from Barbies, G.I. Joe, Monopoly. I mean, you name it. These guys have worked on it. Pretty amazing stuff. Not only that, these guys also create all the prototypes for the products. They help brands develop the games. I mean, there's a lot of information here. Matt's an awesome guy. He's got a ton of energy. He's got a great sense of humor. We're going to learn a lot about packaging through him. I hope you enjoy this episode. Do me a favor, hop on Apple or Spotify, click on rate and review the podcast. I'd really appreciate it. All right, everyone, let's get to the show. If you can just give me like a quick rundown of who you are and a little bit about Design Edge, that'd be a great way to kick this off.
Sure. Well, I guess I can't talk about myself without talking about Design Edge. So we're almost one and the same at this point. Before I even exist, my father started the toy industry in 1969,
wow,
working with Ideal Toys and Aurora Toys. And then around the time I was born, he got picked up to go to a company called HG Toys. He was there for a few months. Then they found that they were kind of going out of business. Then he just took the bull by the horns and sort of turned them around. And by 1984, 85, they had gone from, you know, almost going out of business in the 70s to being like one of the top 20 toy companies in the world. But then you fast forward a few years later, when I'm about 13, 14 years old, they had made a whole bunch of bad investments and then got themselves in trouble and were getting bought out by a company in Chicago called Superior. My father was like, did not want to move from New York to Chicago, and started Design Edge out of the garage with my mother, who was an illustrator and an art teacher.
Wow.
And as I'm often joking, as in, you know, I was drafted from day one. born and raised in the toy industry. In fact, when my father worked for HG Toys, they used to use me as a model for packaging. So you can find lots of old toys of like Neon Dukes of Hazzard sets. And I think a phone lineman, like, I don't know what kid was buying that set, but they did, but, you know, a bunch of old things, catalog covers, you know, I was cheap labor and definitely taken advantage of.
Yeah. I mean, that's the way to do it, right? That's why you have kids.
Yeah. Yeah. It's exactly why I have kids. I don't have enough. I should get a full on labor force. ladies, call me if you're interested.
I was watching some of the videos on the Design Edge website, and you guys, you know, you're the Orange County Choppers of toys. You're having a good time, not just designing toys, but the packaging and everything goes along with it.
Yeah, we definitely are, you know, my other stock joke, but it's true, is like, we call ourselves the other Italian family business, right? So, my work, grew up working with my parents and my cousins, and my sister was here for a long time too, before she went off and started doing her own things. But yeah, we do it through and through. We are the back end to dozens of toy companies, and packaging is a huge part of that. In fact, my degree is actually in packaging. I studied packaging at the Fashion Institute of Technology.
That's awesome. I just had Aaron Brashear, who's an instructor at FIT in packaging. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of great designers coming out of FIT. Was the idea to go to school for packaging to come back into the family business?
No, I was sort of the prodigal son, right? So I left when I was about 18. So about 18, 19, I went to actually initially the Art Students League in Manhattan, which, if you're not familiar, is just an all-out fine art school. Like George O'Keefe went there. It's an institution. And I was doing fine art for a little while. And I was doing gallery shows around the New York City and in at the outer areas. And was fortunate enough when I was 20 to have my first one-man show. The New York Times did a two-page review, which was, you know, great. And I thought that was going to be my career path. But as time was progressing, all of a sudden I realized like I wasn't really making that much money doing that. And I was working more and more on the side with my parents. And then I decided to go to FIT and study advertising. And then that parlayed into packaging.
Wow. So you started the packaging side. And then when do you transition to the toy side?
Well, toys was always there.
Okay.
And the crazy thing is, even when I was going to FIT, you know, they're churning out students to work for the likes of L'Oreal and Estee Lauder. And right. I'm the only kid in that class who's like, I want to do toys. And the teacher's like, you want to do toys? They all thought like toys was like a lowbrow art, but I'm like, I'm lowbrow. This is perfect. You know? And, you know, and all my stuff always had like a whimsical sense of humor to it. And I hated doing perfume packaging and all, but they made us do a lot of it. But then I got out of school, and then packaging was, it's a huge part of toys. So for every product that's designed, you know, there could be 10, 15 different versions of that package that are turned out, and packaging's used for sales meetings and whatnot. So, you know, sometimes the product doesn't even exist. We're just doing fake packaging for it. So packaging is huge in the toy industry. It's the front line of sales at retail and both to the consumer and to the buyer at retail.
I'm just thinking, you know, Christmas just went by, right? Holidays just went by. So like as you're walking down the aisle at Target, you've got the game aisle, and each game is a gigantic billboard for whatever the product is in there, right? It's trying to create, you know, some sort of like emotional pull to the game. Like if you're looking at like Risk, right? It's like this battle happening on the cover, and then you've got like the silly games, like the where you draw with your nose on the board, you know, those types of games. And then those are kind of goofy, and you've got all these different artistic styles on the pack. So with your experience, like what needs to be on the front of a board game, for example, like what are the critical things that have to be on there?
Right. Well, I can answer this one.
Hey, PDU crew, I want you to go to diecuttemplates.com/unboxed, UNBOXD right now. And the reason is because I know how difficult it is to create die lines, how time consuming it is to do it in Illustrator. And if you don't have tens of thousands of dollars to be using other programs, and all you want to do is get to the packaging design, diecuttemplates.com/unboxed is the right solution. Over 700 die lines, type in your dimensions, your material weight. If you want to add locks, if you want to add windows, any type of construction you're looking for, they've got it, and you can customize it to your needs. Check out diecuttemplates.com/unboxed, UNBOXD, and let me know what you think.
Well, so the game wall, and you got to remember, actually, at Target and Walmart, it's not even just an aisle. It's a whole wall. It's the back wall, this game. Games have blown up exponentially, particularly during COVID, of course, but they have been ramping up for the past 20 years. When it comes to game packaging, particularly, the comparison I always use is like game packaging is like a person you meet in a bar that you haven't had the courage to talk to just yet. The front of that package is how attractive that person is and what pulls you in. And the back of that package is how intelligent they are. Right. So you have to be able to engage. You have to be able to draw them in with imagery that really attracts them on the front. But it also has to be able to tell somewhat of the story, but not it can be a little sexier than your average toy package. You know, books can be more. I mean, they can be more in the vein of a book jacket sure. design than they are in say like an action figure, which has to tell, you know, points of articulation and whatever the license is. So yes, that's the main pull. Things that I wary of in game packaging is it is a huge wall. I mean, it is the whole back of that. So you really need to go and study and see what's out there because you need to make sure that you're going to stand out. And common mistakes I see all package designers do in that aisle is monochromatic packaging, which is a terrible idea because it just becomes a giant piece of camouflage. It may work for the likes of Estee Lauder or L'Oreal, but not in the toy aisle or the game aisle.
You know, you talked about highbrow, lowbrow. You've got that same thing happening in the game aisle, right? You've got like the kids games. There's one, I don't know, like you step in poop or something like that. I'm sure you've seen. Don't step in. Yes. Do you guys have a hand in that?
We work with Spin Master, the guys who produce that game.
Yes. So there's, you know, there's a game where you don't step in poop, and then there's the higher brow, more established games, and they all kind of share that same space, but we all play games. So how do you appeal to different people? But at the same time, it's like kind of the same person, because I would buy the poop one to goof around with my kids, but I would play Risk with my older kids. Like, how do you, you know, how, is that an issue, or do you just come up with the idea and you're just running with it? Like, how does that apply to packaging?
Well, at this point, a lot of it's become innate, right? So it's hard for me to figure out what the psychology behind it is. But games are for all ages, and they always sort of have been, but they're more so now than ever. And toys are becoming that way too. As you notice behind me, action figures, you know, there's a lot of guys collect action figures. And, you know, what was odd is when I was a kid, I can remember hearing about, you know, adult Japanese reading comic books and collecting toys. And I thought that was so bizarre. And now that's commonplace here, right?
Right.
I remember you used to think anime was like adults were watching anime movies, and that was strange. Now animated movies are adults go to. Yep. You shouldn't be fooled into thinking that the toy market is just for children, you know, but it needs to appeal to all. And a good sense of humor is probably your best weapon in your arsenal.
I like the idea of having a sense of humor for packaging when it comes to games, right? I mean, you're buying a game to have a good time. Who doesn't want to have a good time?
Yeah. And I think to digress to what I was saying before, when my teachers were like, toy packaging, but it's the same way, you know, people would frown upon comedy years ago, right? That was just like a lowbrow art. But over time, like, people sort of discover there's a lot of intelligence behind comedy. And yeah, it's not just, you know, poop jokes, although it is essentially a poop joke, but it's a great one.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. So you mentioned that you work with Spin Master. You said you're the back end to a lot of toy companies. Uh-huh. So do you only work with established toy companies, or are people like knocking on the back door going, hey, I got an idea for a game. You know, how do we make this happen?
It's very much both. So we work with very large companies, like you mentioned Monopoly, right? So we did a couple of new versions of Monopoly and Sorry and Clue this year for Mattel, and Mattel's mm-hmm. the largest toy company in the world. And we've also helped startups launch their own. They have one game and they want to break into the market. And it's not just a matter of me helping them with their packaging and their design, but we also, as I said, we're the back end. So we will manufacture for them. We dictate pricing. So we know what the pricing structure needs to be. And when we line them up with distribution, so that it's not just like make it, put it in your garage and sell it to your friends and give the rest away for the next 45 Christmas.
Yeah. I just saw, like, over the holidays, I just saw Target has a Monopoly.
Yeah. There's so many versions of Monopoly, you know, actually for the first time in a long time. So we did the Spider-Verse Monopoly as a Walmart exclusive. It's out right now. Mm-hmm. And it was, my kids were totally ecstatic. I'm like, we've made so many cool things with design. And this is the thing that they love. They love Monopoly, you know? And the crazy thing is, growing up, I didn't like Monopoly, mostly because my sisters would cheat and I would just get frustrated. But I've learned now to really like it. And it was really cool doing the Spider-Man version, because, you know, normally you get like a style guide and they say, you have to use this artwork. And that's what's, but aside from the Spider-Man logo and the Monopoly logo, they gave us carte blanche, and they actually had us re-illustrate everything from, because Disney, who owns Marvel, wanted it to be completely fresh and original. So that was an honor. I never thought I'd see the day when they weren't insisting that we had to use the in-house Marvel or Disney illustrators.
Working with a Mattel, they typically would give you a style guide. Here's, you know, here's the colors, here's the imagery. But in this case, it was like, it's Monopoly, go crazy. You guys are the experts.
Yeah. And that's becoming more and more the norm. I don't know if it's because of where our reputation is, or if just in general, people in marketing at these, you know, large companies are just realizing that style guides fall flat, and they really just, they can really trap, especially in the toy industry. When, you know, I think years ago there was like this great, you know, we'll own a whole section, we'll have 3 feet and all look the same, right? Everyone will know it's us. But that's also what the cost of all your product is now lost in this wall of the style guide, that you can't tell, you know, one item from the other unless you pick them all up and stare at them. There's a good move away from the classic style guide into, you know, ancillary packaging. You know, obviously logos maintain, you know, you don't want to lose that, but everything else, no longer logo has to be, you know, 5% of top corner, and, you know, font needs to be 12 point in bottom corner. You know, that seems to be gone.
So just talking about like specifications like that, when you're doing toy packaging and game packaging, what's the regulatory like on that? Because, you know, you talk about L'Oreal, I've done cosmetics, and there's regulatory on that is a nightmare sometimes, where it's like, hey, all of a sudden we've got five languages and, you know, your entire design gets screwed up.
Yes, yes, yes.
How's that work for toys and games? What kind of regulatory are you dealing with there?
We deal with that on a constant level. I mean, there's, you know, toys are heavily regulated, but, you know, there are warnings that have to go on it, like a choking warning or whatnot, and they're scaled to a certain size. There are, you know, certain things are dictated, like, you know, ages and you know, set includes lists and whatnot, all have to be on there. As far as multiple language packaging, we do that heavily for Europe, of course, and Canada. Canada, I find to be a nightmare for packaging, because not only does it have to, you know, do we need to have French and English, but they have to be the same scale.
Right. So how does that work on the front of pack? Cause I, you know, I've done that on cosmetics where you've got small text. So you just kind of you can balance it out, but would that apply to like Operation or Monopoly?
Yeah,
or
it applies to everything. That's just Canadian law. You know, wow. So in effect, Canada has some of the ugliest packaging in the world. You know, but Quebec needs to be able to buy things too.
That's right. It's a big market. Cool, man. So when talking about like Mattel working with those guys, and you know, they give you carte blanche on the Spider-Verse. Is there like a strategy discussion that happens? Like, here's where we want to go. Like, what does a strategy discussion look like for?
Yeah, there's a lot of back and forth. You know, they you know, there's a product manager. The product manager comes in, and you know, they'll liaison between Disney and us, and whereas just there's a lot of ideation in a project like that, and it goes in this feedback, and then things are compiled, and then rethought out, and you know, it's a longer process than it probably should be, but you're also dealing with a brand that's they know they're going to sell a ridiculous amount right out the gate, so they want to get it perfect.
Sure.
And perfect doesn't necessarily mean the most aesthetically pleasing or the best billboarding package. It also has to fit Spider-Man's world properly. You know, there's a lot going on and something like that.
Wow. And then so having been in the toy industry, in packaging for as long as you have been, you know, as a family business as well, I see that you're also part of this group of inventors, toys and games. You're inventing these things. Should designers consider themselves inventors?
You know, that's a tricky one, because I am an inventor, and we've been fortunate. Design Edge has done quite a lot of inventing over the years, and we make a nice chunk of change just on, you know, coming up with ideas and licensing them to large and small toy companies. Not all designers are inventors. It's a different type of mindset. I mean, yes, they can cross over a bit, but designers sometimes will get too caught up in the details while inventing. At least the initial brushstrokes need to be broad. Yeah. So, but it's tricky because there's also inventing in packaging. Right.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So, you know, outside of toys, we do things outside of toys. So we supply a lot of those coffee boxes that you buy at delis, you know, large retail stores, you know, the ones with the bags in them.
Oh, yeah.
One of our clients has the patent on that.
Wow.
And we design and we'll tweak that every couple of months and do it for everybody, you know, from Panera Bread to Dunkin' Donuts to whomever. And that's a packaging innovation. There's an invention right there, as is the sleeve that goes on a cup of coffee, right? That's a packaging innovation. That's an invention, and people overlook those. And oddly enough, the guy who did the sleeve and the guy who did the coffee box know each other, and it's just crazy.
So you also talk about inventors' rights. Hey, I want to introduce you to idpdirect.com. We recently won a Silver Pen Awards for collaborating on the future of sustainable packaging. If you want to work directly with the packaging manufacturer and you're tired of distributors and middlemen, check them out. Visit idpdirect.com to learn more.
Check out SpecRite, the number one platform for specification management. Not sure what board your box uses? Not sure how many colors or how much headspace your packaging requires? If you don't SpecRite, you'll guess wrong. SpecRite.com.
If you want to learn more about sustainable packaging, join Corey Connors, Adam Peake, and myself on LinkedIn every Monday at 7:30 a.m. Pacific Standard Time for the Packaging Design News Weekly broadcast, where Corey, Adam, and I share the latest news in packaging in 15 minutes or less, brought to you by Ubuntu. You can learn more about Ubuntu by going to sustainablepackaging.io and joining with the code packaging25. Ubuntu is going to create a custom newsletter for you that is going to deliver the latest in sustainable packaging every week, along with our news broadcast. We're really excited about this partnership, and we hope you join us on Ubuntu. Go to sustainablepackaging.io and use code packaging25. Right. So let's say for packaging, for a packaging innovation, what are some of these inventor rights and what should people be looking for?
That's a tricky. So it's all industry specific. So it can get tricky, but yeah, there are, you need, you need to really watch yourself and know what you're dealing with. And if you're an inventor within a certain industry and you know how that industry works, you might be fine. But if you're not within an industry, you might want to find yourself a broker who understands that area, because there's a million ways for inventors to get screwed.
And right.
So I do sit on the board of directors of the United Inventors Association of America, which is the world's largest inventor advocacy and education group. They're a great resource. So if you're interested in, you know, learning more about inventing, I recommend that you go there. If you're into toys particularly, you can join the People of Play, and that will also give you some great education.
Awesome.
Those are the main resources I would point you to. But every industry is a little different, and their royalty structures are different, and you know what's required. You know, some industries demand a patent, so others don't.
Mm-hmm.
So, toys, you don't particularly need a patent. In fact, I find patenting for toys could be a complete waste of money, because toys are fashion based. So by the time you apply and get the patent, your concept could go to market, be huge, then come down, and then never be seen again. And then your patent comes in.
Yeah. Wow. So yeah, so it doesn't work in terms of timing.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. Cause I see a lot of packaging designers that like develop packaging structures, like that's their focus. Mm-hmm. And you know, they'll come up with concepts and they'll share those freely to their clients. They've invented a new structure. They've invented a new way to interact with packaging, but they don't realize that, you know, maybe they can do something a little bit more, but, you know, own that design if it is technical enough, or, you know, if it makes sense.
If there's a proper utility to that package, there may be some great avenues for them to explore. It may go beyond the industry to which they are designed it for. You can be putting a lot on the table and screw things up.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy. To my father was one of the first guys to do single pizza slice boxes for Sbarro's like many, many, many years ago. And I wish he put a patent on that, because to my knowledge and from what I've researched, that box did not exist until he did that box. And we could have done that pretty darn well.
The triangular folding.
Yeah.
Clamshell. Yeah.
Yeah. You know,
and we've done some
interesting packaging for companies like Hooters, which is odd. Like, but one of my big jokes is that our clients range from Hasbro to Hooters, because it's true. but just using different types of laminates and coatings to, you know, allow for, you know, wings to go in there and not soak through a corrugated clamshell.
Yeah. So then getting, you know, going to like the toy packaging. With a lot of toy packaging, you know, you're like what you've got behind you. There's the clamshell, there's the backer board, and then, you know, there's a million different print processes that can happen, right? There's foils, there's UVs, all these different treatments that can happen on the packaging. How important is sustainability in toy and game packaging today? And is sustainability kind of a hindrance to toy packaging and what needs to happen there?
Well, it's a necessary hindrance, right? Mm-hmm. You know, that's just where the world's going, and we all have to be more conscious of our footprint. I would hope that the bigger innovations, as we were just talking about inventing, would actually be in breakthroughs in materials, right? How can we manufacture more sustainable packaging, opposed to necessarily, you know, lowering the overall footprint of the package all the time to the point where it has no marketability. Mm-hmm. But you know, we've been very conscious to like remove plastic tie strips, and we're using less and less blisters, and you know, just different types of processes. We're just not doing different types of materials that, you know, using PET over, you know, PVC, but it feels like it's not moving fast enough. But I'm sure in hindsight, I'll look back and be like, wow, what a huge difference. I'm sure if I look at what we were doing 5 years ago and look at what we're doing today, I would see like a major difference. But you know, I'm so close to England.
Yeah.
It's, you know, literally against my nose.
Yeah. So what 5 years ago to today, what are the trends that you've seen kind of develop over that period?
Well, mostly, you know, reducing the overall footprint. Mm-hmm. So when I started in this industry, you couldn't make the box big enough. Right. They, you know, the whole idea was the kids wanted this giant, you know, this giant piece, mm-hmm. you know, and that was part of the excitement. And I'm sure when we were kids, if you find pictures of Christmas morning, the toys are all gigantic. You know? you know, now it's, you know, make it as small and concise as you possibly can. And again, removing windows and twist ties and, you know, those things really add up over time. You know, if you're, you know, a mammoth toy company and you've got, you know, five wire ties in every single package you sell and you're selling, you know, billions of toys a year, that's a lot of plastic.
Are those wire ties still manually applied?
Well, they're manually applied and they're coated.
Yeah. You know,
because they got to be, or they're zip ties. Again, both are types of plastic. But now we're using paper ties.
I never thought back to, as a kid, having packaging be bigger, you know, because it was better. It didn't matter if there's like, you know, half of it was air. You just wanted this. You all went for the big gift.
Yeah.
And today we're reducing the size, which makes sense. But with toy packaging and size reduction, are you having to develop more of a unboxing experience, like kind of layering things in there to make it more memorable?
I would feel like that whole unboxing experience, really, to my knowledge, and maybe it's just because it's the world I live in, really came out of the toy business, right? Well, those initial unboxing videos were all little YouTube stars and TikTok and you know, just opening up toys. Yes, the unboxing experience is very important. That experience is now cemented in people's over because they'll film it, right? And there's people who do nothing but unbox stuff. You know, it's crazy, but it's cool. You know, it gives more attention to the package. And also, we've seen tremendously successful toys birthed out of simply packaging. You know, LOL Surprise is a great example, you know, of a very successful toy that's packaging based. It's the packaging is primary and the toy is almost ancillary.
Have you guys produced some of that product?
I have not, you know, it is a prime example and something that is often cited when people come to us. But like toys, you know, it's fashion based. So as soon as someone has a hit with something, everyone's knocking your door to have, you know, the very similar but not quite the same item.
100%.
Parallel marketing. Yes.
It's funny because I just spent, I don't know, like 10 minutes recording some LOL Surprise boxes that I ran across at Target, and they'd done this like bellows construction. It was really complex, and I mean, it had to have been all manual labor to assemble this thing. So when you're talking about toy packaging and creating this unboxing experience, you know, you guys design it, you mentioned you manufacture it. Do you own the manufacturing? How does that work?
We do the majority of our manufacturing in China. Then we do some tiger countries as well as, you know, domestic here in the States. I don't own any factories. You know, we sort of broker or agent it, but not too many. I don't know any Americans who own a factory in China. In fact, even Chinese don't own factories in China. China has factories in China. But I have very long lasting relationships. So I have been going back and forth to China since 1996. Wow. I lived in Hong Kong for a little while. We have two satellite offices in China, and you know, it's back and forth every single day. In fact, they called me this morning at 5 a.m., which I was like, geez, thanks. But we're heavily involved in manufacturing.
Awesome. And then you mentioned that you do prototypes sometimes. Are you building those prototypes in-house?
Yes. So here in New York, I have a 5,000 square foot facility with you know, obviously a big design lab, as well as a sound studio, as well as a full on, you know, machine shop. And then we do light. We don't do any manufacturing, but it's all prototyping. Mm-hmm. So it's everything from sculpting action figures to packaging samples and comps and construction studies.
Wow.
Love my construction studies. That's a great place to start.
Awesome. So your design process, when you're, you know, somebody knocks on the back door and they're like, hey, I got an idea for this product. What do you guys do? Like, is it a sketch? Do you guys start sketching and then go to prototypes? Like, how does that work? And what do you guys do there?
Yeah, it usually starts off with sketching.
Mm-hmm.
It usually starts with me being obnoxious to my own client and telling them to throw out all their old preconceived notions. And I want to start from scratch. And usually that works. No, but yeah, we go, you know, literally right to the drawing board. I just keep stacks of Sharpie markers and just in like a ream of 8.5 by 11 and just a you know, and just keep just banging things out until we've got some sort of very rough idea of what we want to do. And then we start just building, you know, rough prototypes, and then they get refined and they get refined and they get refined until we're actually at the point, if we're talking packaging, it turns into die lines. If we're talking about, you know, product design, then we're, you know, we start to get into CADs and different sorts of schematics and whatever's required to get it made.
Yeah. So is your team made up of packaging designers or industrial designers, or do you have like a mix of both? How does that?
Sort of a mix of both until they work here and they become all of it. You know, it's a very unique business, and toys in general are just a crazy business because, you know, work with certain industries and they only know these five materials and then, you know, how to produce them. And that's that. While in toys, it's this toy is made of wood, this one's made out of metal, this one needs to be injection molded, this one's rotocast. Can we make this out of a vac form? This one should be all paper. Is it E-flute? Is B flute? You know, maybe we can make this out of, you know, some sort of other stock, you know. So it's anything and everything goes in toys.
So it sounds to me like if you're graduating, you know, industrial designer, packaging designer, maybe toys is like a great place to start. Because you're gonna touch every print process, every material.
Yeah, I would think so. Well, it depends on your capacity to learn and your ability not to get frustrated, because it's gonna be a lot thrown at you quickly. And it gets trickier and trickier because not much manufacturing is done here in the States, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And I was fortunate to grow up in a time when a lot of it was. So I got a very early education. But I go and I speak at schools all over the place, and no one really knows manufacturing anymore. In fact, they'll bring me in to help talk to the students about manufacturing processes and how to design for them.
Does your team then design for manufacturing, or do they take it to a certain point and then hand it over?
We design for manufacturing. In fact, even factories will even hire us to fix things for them.
Wow. I'm teaching a class here at ASU, and a big part of the packaging program is, I don't want to just see your portfolio. I want to see how you set up your file, right? Because if, you know, are you the guy that's showing up with, you know, 100 layers that are, you know, RGB and not named, or, you know, you've got die lines, you know, foil, you know, you got everything organized, because it makes a big difference. You know, who am I going to hire?
The RGB reference is fantastic because I love when I see that, you know, or when I work with some company that's just hired some kid out of art school, and now that person's creative director. They're small, and then they send me their files, and I'm like, their files are a mess. This there's not even a proper die line on things, or the colors are all over the place, and then they're trying to figure out like, why it didn't print so well, why is all the orange brown? I'm like, because you did it in RGB. Like, that's gonna happen. It's a fifth color. Do you even know what a fifth color is? You know, it's like,
no, exactly. That's the thing, that it's a big part of what's missing in design education, right? It's like, am I printing an opaque white? Am I printing a white underprint? Am I printing this flexo? Like, how do I set up the file for these different things? Because if you don't know how to set it up, what you're doing is you're creating an idea of what you want. Then you're handing it off to somebody else to just do whatever they want in order to get it across their machines.
Well, especially if you're dealing with overseas manufacturing, they're not going to fix your files. They're going to take what you gave them and reproduce it. And then I've heard so many times, you know, China screwed that up. I'm like, no, you screwed that up. Like, you didn't know what you were doing. But nobody wants to hear that. It's easier to blame the big red monster on the other side of the world, right?
What makes packaging in games and toys collectible? Like, what's the one thing, if somebody's designing a game today, what's going to make that collectible?
That is a good question. What's going to make a game packaging collectible? Well, contrary to popular belief, it's not hot stamping or spot glossing. It's just making sure that it communicates properly and that it's got an aesthetic that people are going to want to display. I would say that's what's going to make something collectible. Also helps if the toy or game is fun to begin with.
Awesome. That's it for the show. Thanks so much for joining us on Package Design Unboxed. If you have any questions, you can find me on LinkedIn. I'm always available for questions. Once again, check us out at PackageDesignUnboxed. www.designedge.com.